coming to terms with the painful past of domestic terrorism in America. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg.
We've done very little to acknowledge this history. Most Americans can't name a single black person who was lynched between 1877 and 1950.
And sadly, hate crimes have occurred multiple times in more recent years as well. From the anti-gay murder of Matthew Shepard at Laramie, Wyoming in 1998, to the 22 people gunned down in an anti-Latino massacre at the Walmart in El Paso, Texas in 2019. Racial and ethnic tensions seem to be a constant of American life, usually restrained but sometimes erupting in raw, full view. I sat down with Yale historian David Blight.
I have here a photo taken in Indiana in 1930, 65 years after the Civil War. Can you describe this image?
Yes, there are two black men hanging dead from a tree. It's dated as August 7, 1930, in Marion, Indiana. Their names, let's name them, were, as it says here, Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith.
They look like very young men.
They're very young men. The crowd beneath them looking around at the camera, and something has illuminated this, lights have illuminated this somehow, is entirely white. A couple of the men are wearing neckties. There are women, young and older, in the photo. Some of the people are looking up at the two dead bodies. Some are smiling and laughing. Some are simply pointing.
Sort of a smirk.
Yes, there is a smirk. And it's a kind of an outing. It's almost a festive occasion, which is what happened at many of these lynch mobs. They were not in any danger of being arrested. They were not in any danger of, you know, police activity. It was simply assumed when a lynching occurred in your community, there must have been good justification. Now, it should be said, too, that there was always an element of the white South who hated this. There always was. The trouble, they not only hated it, they condemned it, they wished it away. On the other hand, they never could sustain a consensus. It was when a lynching occurred in a town, it was usually bad for the town. You know, a mayor would have to come out and say, we should not do this. You know, we should not do this. He's just had a lynch mob murder somebody in public with no police action. And all a mayor could come out and say is, this is bad.
So who are these people who are gathered?
Common citizens and of all ranks and classes. I'm mentioning here one guy in a white shirt with a tie. Now, we don't know exactly what he did or what he does. As I said, young women in the photo. There are many photos like this, as you well know. They're the heart of evil in American history, perhaps visually more than anything else. But it shows that of the, oh gosh, we have a lot of statistics now on lynching, but somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 such lynchings occurred from about 1890 to 1920. There were years when there was...
We're looking at one from 1930.
Yes, that's late in the process, but they keep going on into the 30s. And there's even a few in the 50s.
So why are these people drawn to this atrocity?
Well,
why is it a festive occasion? I'm truly having trouble wrapping my brain around
this. Well, it's a spectacle killing. It's not unlike hangings used to be in the 19th century or the 18th century. Hangings were, by definition, a public event. It was supposed to send a message. This is what happens to the worst of criminals. It's a public ritual of white supremacy. It's a demonstration of a community's control. It's a demonstration to the black community No one ever forgot where the lynching tree was. No one ever forgot what, what's his name here? Abram Smith looked like, hanging on a rope from a tree. Sometimes the bodies were burned in a kind of medieval ritual.
Burning at the stake?
Burning at the stake, but also the sort of ritual burning of evil. You are burning that out of existence.
During this time period, it was very dangerous for people to speak out against the horror of lynching.
Brian Stevenson, founder of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama.
Anyone who was critical, who lived in the American South, would then be targeted. Mary Turner, an African-American woman in Georgia, complained about the fact that her husband had been brutally lynched, and the mob came and slaughtered her and her unborn child at the time. And so there was this long history and practice of silence around that. And creative people, artists, began to challenge that. And Abe Mirapol wrote these lyrics that described the horror of seeing black bodies dangling from trees throughout the American South. And Billie Holiday set it to music and then started making these haunting recordings.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
She would perform this song at performances, and while she was very festive and capable of engaging in unruly, loud club setting, on almost all of her music, when she would sing Strange Fruit, she would require silence, and she would make people pay attention to these words, which for her expressed the anguish, the suffering, the grief that was so epidemic in African-American life throughout this period. And it's one of those songs that stands out as both a indictment of American society for what it tolerates and as a plea for a deeper commitment to eliminating bigotry and bias and discrimination.
A voice steadfastly speaking out against this injustice was the late journalist Ida B. Wells, who advocated for strong legislation to outlaw and punish the perpetrators of domestic terrorism. Her biographer, Paula Giddings.
Well, what Ida wants, and Ida has called for years, is that there be a federal anti-lynching bill. She said lynching is a national crime. It's not just it's a national crime and needs federal legislation. And it takes the NAACP a long time to get to that. But once they do adopt, once lynching does become at the center of the organization, that's the first time that blacks really begin to trust the NAACP.
It was in 1916 that the NAACP formed a special committee to advocate for anti-lynching legislation. It took more than a century for Congress to pass the Justice for Victims of Lynching Act in 2018, which was approved by the Senate unanimously. Congress had tried and failed some 200 times to pass similar legislation. Perpetrators were rarely held accountable.
Lynchings were crimes that were committed against innocent Americans, and their families never received justice in our courts of law.
California Senator Kamala Harris co-sponsored the bill.
This is an uncomfortable history. To think of it, to talk of it, understandably, makes many people uncomfortable because of the violence that we are describing, because it is part of America's history. because it is something that we have never truly acknowledged and reconciled.
And passage of the anti-lynching law so many years later was partial fulfillment of Ida B. Wells' vision of justice.
She is there as a remarkable example of an intrepid and, importantly, woman activist.
Yale University historian David Blight.
Born in the very heart of the society where lynching exploded, and never let Americans forget, she argued, you know, that the creeds of America are at stake in this. She didn't denounce the United States, she denounced lynchers and anyone who would enable them. That's important because often in the radical, you know, protest tradition, we forget, I think, that the deepest tradition is a kind of radical Americanism, too. It's saying, look, we supposedly believe this, this, that, and that. And we enshrined it sort of in the first Constitution and the Bill of Rights. But the trouble is, we also enshrined slavery. But then we enshrined it again in the second Constitution, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And we enshrined it in the Reconstruction Acts. And now we've enshrined it in the Civil Rights Acts of the 60s, even deeper. But here we are again, debating the same damn thing. Who's equal? What's an American? What are our rights? Who gets access to power? Do you have to have wealth to have power? Who speaks for workers, common people? What is access to learning and education? What is equality in the 21st century? You know, the ultimate thing Americans need to understand is that this experiment, trouble as it is, this thing, America, is never over. It's a permanent problem. It's a permanent experiment.
We are exploring the violent history of white supremacy in America and efforts today to come to terms with that past. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information on this segment, Ida B. Wells' Battle to Uncover the Truth, and to obtain audio downloads or CDs, please visit humanmedia.org. The lynch mobs of America in the late 19th and early 20th century represent an especially twisted dimension of the human psyche. When society begs off upholding the norms of civilized behavior and abandons basic ethics, these depraved tendencies can rise to the surface. Brian Stevenson.
I think it is a consequence of the way people are acculturated, and I don't think it's much different than what you saw in Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s, or what you saw in Rwanda in the early 1990s, or what we've seen in Eastern Europe, or what we've seen in Cambodia. It was a way of demonizing another group of people, making them responsible for all the ills of that community, otherizing them to the point where their humanity and their dignity and their lives had no value. And when you stood against that, you stood for that white community. And that kind of acculturation was at the heart of what happened during this time period.
Following the Civil War, innocent African Americans sometimes faced mob violence. Although Union troops initially remained stationed in some parts of the former Confederate states, their presence in the South was temporary. And over time, federal authorities stopped enforcing the civil rights that had been guaranteed to black citizens by the post-war constitutional amendments.
It has a lot to do with the fact that nobody was really committed to the idea of racial equality. I mean, even leaders in the North were at best conflicted on the question of racial equality, and at worst, quite hostile to the idea. And it starts with Abraham Lincoln and people who have long been celebrated for their perspectives on slavery. But he was not committed to the notion of racial equality. He was not convinced that full emancipation meant full rights. And so many of the radical Republicans who were closer to that idea slowly began to abandon that as a winnable or even conceivable idea to advance, and you begin to see retreat. And it's retreat in the North that then allows the fervent opposition to racial equality in the South to go unchallenged. And once that happens, there's no likelihood that Black people are going to have the right to vote or are going to have the opportunity to be protected. The Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, plays a critical role in this. Congress had passed several laws that were designed to protect Black people. The Ku Klux Klan Act, the Civil Rights Acts, were all intended to empower federal prosecutors to hold people accountable for some of this violence. The United States Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, struck down those laws, essentially held that states, not the Congress, had the power to decide how to implement these provisions and who would have authority to enforce them. And so once the United States Supreme Court basically blocked any kind of federal enforcement, there was very little chance that Black people would be protected from mob violence. I mean, I don't know that even with the court's intervention, it would have happened if there wasn't the political will to enforce these laws. But without the Supreme Court, there was no chance.
Jim Crow segregation eventually prevailed through much of the South, emboldening white supremacists there. They were determined to preserve a system of separate and unequal.
We have this period from the end of the Civil War until the 1950s where mobs could carry out acts of racial terror and violence with impunity. That only really starts to end in the 40s and 50s when the threat of a federal response grows.
We present a special address by the President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Disorderly mobs have deliberately prevented the carrying out of proper orders from a federal court. Local authorities have not eliminated that violent opposition. And under the law, I yesterday issued a proclamation calling upon the mob to disperse. This morning, the mob again gathered in front of the Central High School of Little Rock, obviously for the purpose of again preventing the carrying out of the court's order relating to the admission of Negro children to that school.
We then have this historic movement of civil rights activism in the 1950s and 60s that results in the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. But there was tremendous resistance to that, both in the North and the South, but particularly in the South. And so in the 70s and the 80s and in the 90s, we are still fighting over full enforcement of the right to vote and the right to integrated education and the right to services. I mean, my state of Alabama still has a state constitutional provision that prohibits Black and white kids from going to school together. It's in our state constitution. And the only way you can change that is through a statewide referendum, which was attempted in 2004. And the majority of people in this state voted to keep the language that prohibits Black and white kids from going to school together, even though it's unenforceable under the federal constitution. An attempt was made in 2012, and an even larger percentage of people voted to keep that language. And so we are still engaged in this narrative struggle, and people are still very resistant to the idea of racial equality. There is still enormous bigotry, bias, and discrimination that gets directed to people of color. And unchallenged, we will continue to see resistance to the kind of eradication of thinking that is represented by lynching.
Americans always insist that we are a society of progress.
Historian David Blight.
There's a good reason we want to believe that. But you know, if we could just stop for a while insisting that everything has to be progress, we might then be ready. when history shows us that it's not. When history whacks us in the face with a tragedy we don't understand, or a crisis that just happens and we wonder, where does this come from? How could this kid in South Carolina walk into a black church and murder all those people? How could that mob be so big in Charlottesville? Who knew there were so many white supremacists in America?
As we've noted, racial lynchings were not confined to the American South. One especially heinous incident took place in Duluth, Minnesota in 1920, where three black men were hung from a lamppost downtown. The victims, Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee, are among those honored at the National Memorial for People Murdered in Lynchings. Each victim is symbolized by a steel pillar, 800 of them hanging from a roof. It was dedicated in 2018 in Montgomery, Alabama. In attendance was Carl Crawford, the human rights officer for Duluth, and Carl Huber, a University of Minnesota educator. First, Carl Crawford.
Perfect strangers stopped and noticed the pain of people. A soft hand on your back, others recognizing that this happened and how painful that was. And then the challenge when we saw the memorial, the three names from our community, and realized the magnitude of all the other names.
The picture that haunts me in kind of a powerful, frightening, unfrightening, overwhelming is being in the memorial for the first time, having gone through, it's the third turn and now all the pillars are raised. And the sun was shining through and some of them looked just amber, like they were glowing. And I looked up and after having taken in all the names from previous till I got to that point, I felt frozen. And yet I could move forward, but it was a feeling of total, this horror what had happened, but also a feeling of just total confusion in myself. What had happened here? That spot, and I think the way the light was hitting in that moment and the emotion has stayed with me. And it's kind of been a point of grief for me. There have been waves. I don't know, Carl, if you've experienced, I've had waves of grief after being back.
And that's the amazing part of this journey. Amongst the grief, we found love. We found compassion. We still found reasons to smile amongst the tears. And as painful as the journey as it is, it was a story that needed to be told.
I don't have any difficulty in imagining what should happen.
Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative.
As a person of faith, there's a scripture that's often quoted, but not frequently followed, from the book of Micah, where the question is posed, what does God require of us? And the answer is given that we do justice, that we love mercy, and that we walk humbly. I think we have failed to do justice. We have failed to embrace mercy. And in many ways, the work that we are trying to do is rooted in this idea that our nation must recover, can recover, should recover, despite the brutality of this history. I just think it means that we have to commit to an era of truth and justice.
You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliart Rose. Editorial assistance from Jake Kavicki, Kathy Graham, and Ken Rogers. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Callie Hope Reardon. We also thank Philip Martin and Shenteria Childs, Kyle Gassiot, the Chicago Humanities Festival, Smith College, Minnesota Public Radio News, David Cruz, and Tony Buck. Our program is presented by Human Media.
You can access free written materials related to this program as well. Our web address is humanmedia.org. Again, humanmedia.org.
And you can subscribe to our free weekly podcast, Humankind on Public Radio, available at Apple Podcasts and elsewhere. This segment, part two of Ida B. Wells' Battle to Uncover the Truth, is Humankind program number 275.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.